afternoon, you're very welcome to today's edition of Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, the Maurice McCabe scandal, who knew what and when, and can the Garda Commissioner stay in place while the investigation happens? A senior cabinet minister knew about the Tuzla file on Sergeant McCabe, but didn't share the information with colleagues. What are the implications for Catherine Zappone? And Health Minister Simon Harris promises to make HSE managers accountable for long waiting lists, but can he succeed where so many others have failed? All that to come, but first it's time for the news now with Clodagh Walsh. Clodagh, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne and your views are very welcome on the topics we're about to cover on the programme. 51551 is the text number. You can email saturday@rte.ie and on Twitter it's @SaturdayRTE. Joining us today, Minister for Health Simon Harris, Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD and Health spokesperson, Brendan Howland, Labour Party leader, and Katie Hannan, who is RTE Current Affairs political correspondent. I just want to deal with the news just in relation to the Maurice McCabe story. We have a HSE statement in relation to the Garda Sergeant. Minister, do you want to explain to us what the HSE involvement is here?
Yeah, my understanding, Clare, is that whilst we have known for the last number of days, and it's been much discussed, that an error was clearly made in relation to an accusation about Sergeant Maurice McCabe, it has now transpired that that councillor was a HSE employee. So I think it's very important and right and proper that not just Tuzla offer a full and comprehensive apology to Sergeant McCabe and his family for the distress that they've caused him, but also that the HSE, considering the councillor was an employee of the HSE, would do likewise. I'm very clear also that this piece must be included as part of the work of the Commission of Investigation. I've spoken to the Taoiseach in relation to that this morning and I believe that that can happen.
OK, Fintan O'Toole in the Irish Times asked today, are we dealing with a conspiracy that threatens the fundamental rights of every citizen?
I think Clare, we're all worried as citizens. We all watched Katie's report on primetime. I think we're all worried as citizens about what has been drip information in relation to serious allegations and concerns made by whistleblowers in relation to the workings of An Garda Síochána over a sustained period of time. I think the only way you get to the bottom of this is by a comprehensive commission of investigation. As you know, the government decided on Tuesday to set one up, and the Taoiseach, in establishing one, recommended to Cabinet that we accept in full the recommendations of Judge Earl O'Neill in terms of what that commission should look at. I think it's really important that we actually get on with that job now. I think the men and women of An Garda Síochána, the citizens of this country and the whistleblowers all need the facts to actually be established as quickly as possible, rather than to get into a kind of speculative space that all of us around this table find ourselves being in, because none of us around this table know all of the facts.
And there are question marks over the person who is leading the Gardaí, over the version of events which Noreen O'Sullivan is sticking to, that she did not know about any of this. But the government is clearly saying in setting up this commission, we're not quite sure about what you're telling us. So we're going to get a Supreme Court judge to investigate it. And Patley, he sets this out very clearly in the Irish Times today in a very concise way. And yet we're willing to leave that person in place while this inquiry happens.
No, I think what the government is doing is using mechanisms that were put in place to make sure whistleblowers are heard. And indeed, the government that Brendan and I were a part of brought in a number of reforms to make sure people could come forward and in a safe environment highlight wrongdoing or allegations of wrongdoing. What we can't do, Clare, is become judge and jury on this. And we cannot decide that an allegation is the same as a conviction. The only person that can actually look at allegations, look at all the information and arrive at a judgment is indeed a judge. And therefore, I think it is wholly appropriate that just as whistleblowers should absolutely be heard and taken very seriously and their allegations examined, that those who have allegations made against them also must have an entitlement to due process and to an opportunity to put forward the facts into a domain that can adjudicate on them.
Okay, Brendan Howland.
It's true that everybody is entitled to the presumption of innocence, but it is absolutely normal in public administration that where there are very serious matters alleged against anybody in authority, and few have more authority than the Commissioner of An Garda Síochána, that they would stand aside. Right now, for example, Superintendent Taylor has been out of his job for some considerable time pending the outcome of the inquiry that we're about to set up. I think it is appropriate that the Commissioner would stand aside, because I think the 13,000 men and women of An Garda Síochána need to know that the leadership of An Garda Síochána Síochána now has been driven by people whose sole and exclusive focus is the security of the state and the policing and good policing of the state, and are not distracted by having to defend themselves in any way. A much more fundamental issue, and I think you alluded to it in terms of Fintan O'Toole's article today, is whether what we're about to do now, with what we know even in the last 48 hours, is fit for purpose. And I spoke at length to Maurice McCabe this morning. And he actually is of the view that what we need is something much broader. And he actually is in agreement with the idea put forward by Fintan O'Toole, that what is required now is an external criminal investigation headed by police officers from a force outside of Ireland.
How would that work? How would we put that in place? How would we give them the powers that they would need?
I don't know. In simplistic terms, it would require emergency legislation to be put in place. But I think such is the drip feed of information, and such is the clearly incapacity of the leadership of An Garda Síochána now to deal with all these matters and do the critical, probably most critical business of any agency of state, and that is to protect the citizenry of this state from crime and subversion.
We're not asking the guards to deal with it, though. We're asking the judge to deal with it. So it's been removed from the guard.
Well, the bottom line on all of this is that the most senior people that are named, and including the commissioner, who has been asked to surrender her telephone records, all the communications that she's had, all the paper records that she's had over a 2-year period, and to give sworn evidence herself to the tribunal. Obviously, that is a distraction. There's no gainsaying that. And she is the person in charge of all that information right now. I think it would be give much more public confidence if she stood aside and somebody else took over until all these matters are resolved. She's entitled fully to the presumption of innocence. And there's no suggestion.
Do you think standing aside would not discredit her or remove the presumption of innocence?
Clearly not, because that is the normal procedure. If she was the school principal against whom serious allegations were made, she would be required to stand aside. If she was a parish priest, she'd be required to stand aside. In this particular case, I think that is the appropriate course of action. But as I say, much more fundamentally now, we can't simply park all these matters to another inquiry that will be held quite properly under the terms of the Act in private, that will go on a minimum of 9 months, probably much longer. And we don't know anything in the interim. That will not give the level of confidence that the public demand now. Because I think you have to have some comprehension of how the public are viewing the drip feed of this information. How scandalised all of us are at the details that Katie Hannan's report put into the public domain. Now, I spoke, as I said, to Maurice McCabe. And I can't imagine how difficult it was for him and his family to view that. He told me it was extraordinarily difficult for him to relive it all, as he said. And he's gone
through... How is he, by the way? What form is he in today?
He's very... I said to him, you know, you must be amazingly strong. And he said, no. He said, you know, we're wounded by all of this. And no human being would not be. And he deserves better now. Because when I first spoke to him, I said I should have made contact with him. And I feel I should have earlier than I did. He is somebody who has stood up on the side of right for a long time and has been traduced, has had the most vile of things said about him, and his family were undermined in a way that the rest of us can only imagine.
Did you speak to him about Minister Catherine Zappone not sharing the information that she had about the Tuisla file with her cabinet colleagues?
No, I didn't specifically talk about that. We talked about a number of things. He was very exercised, particularly about the O'Higgins Commission, because he felt he was on trial, and he said that during the O'Higgins Commission. He felt that from the instructions that were given to counsel for the state, that they set out to do him down. And that's a very vulnerable position for any citizen to be in.
Can we talk about the Catherine Zappone issue,
sure.
Minister? I mean, why Do you understand why she wouldn't have said that she was had met the McCabes and had discussed the Tuzla file on Tuesday at the Cabinet meeting?
Yeah, I understand a lot better now than we did earlier yesterday. And I think her second statement, and Minister Zappone's second statement yesterday, I think did help clarify matters. Because what Minister Zappone has said is, I think firstly we've got to accept Minister Zappone's integrity here. She met Sergeant McCabe and she met Mrs. McCabe with a view to wanting to assist. Both the McCabe said yesterday through RTE that they found her to be excellent and sympathetic. So I think we do need to acknowledge that the Minister Zappone was genuinely trying to help establish the truth with the McCabes. Minister Zappone was also very conscious of the fact that the information that she was being told was extraordinarily sensitive. There cannot be information more sensitive than the issue of an allegation of child abuse being made against you and wrongly being
Tuesday were ready on the 27th of January to make an apology to Maurice McCabe.
Yes,
so the mistake had been admitted.
But let's just be clear, and this is not a criticism of Brendan or RTE indeed, but the information was not in the public domain in relation to Sergeant McCabe and the wrongful allegation of child abuse made against him and the distress.
But
that
it is so
caused.
Serious.
So, Minister,
you're trying to formulate terms of reference for an inquiry, and you're not told about this.
And I want to get to that. And I want to get to that because. When I spoke to Minister Zappone last night, I asked the minister that very question. How were you satisfied after having your engagement with Sergeant McCabe that the terms of reference were going to address that? And she clearly said that when she viewed the terms of reference, it was quite clear to her that the terms of reference were capturing the issues that she had discussed with McCabe. Let me just explain why that's the case before we all find it extraordinary. I mean, B in the terms of reference states that the allegations made by Superintendent Taylor in his protected disclosure that he was directed to draw journalists' attention to an allegation of criminal misconduct against Sergeant McCabe and that this was the root cause of his agenda, namely revenge against the Gardaí. That is part B of the terms of reference. So in reading that, Minister Zappone, and indeed I can see why, was of the view that the terms of reference would enable the Commission of Investigation.
When you were speaking to her last night,
and the Taoiseach has also made it clear that the terms of reference will capture all
these. When you spoke to her last night, did you ask her why she said in her first statement that she informed relevant government colleagues about the Tuzla situation?
No, but I asked her to clarify and confirm to me that she hadn't,
because that dropped you in it too. Really,
she made it very clear, and I thought it was unhelpful, the first statement, because I thought it added to the confusion at a time when the last thing that Maurice McCabe and his family need is any more confusion.
And you're clear that you didn't know about it prior to Thursday.
I'm crystal clear that Mrs. McCabe rang my departmental office and was looking to speak to relevant people in relation to allegations regarding Tuzla, and was told by an official that Tuzla was a matter for the Department of Children and Youth Affairs, and that the Department of Children and Youth Affairs.
And you weren't told about that.
And I found out about that yesterday, and I had no prior knowledge of any of this.
Katie and then Louise. Yeah,
yeah. I just who said what to who and how much knowledge was shared. I mean, given what we now know was told to Catherine Zappone at that meeting on the 25th of January, the gravity of what was said, the jaw-dropping nature of what emerged that has really rocked the country, that Catherine Zappone would come away from that meeting and not think, Taoiseach needs to know this, that the Justice Minister has to know this. And the only reason I can imagine that information was not shared was she was not asked for it. It was on the basis of what you don't know won't trouble you, as my mother used to say. And
I don't accept that, obviously.
Well,
I don't accept that, because that's going to the very heart of criticising the bona fides of the Taoiseach on this matter.
If the Taoiseach was made aware, as we were told, that the meeting was taking place between Catherine Zappone and Maurice McCabe, I cannot imagine any circumstances, if you were framing terms of reference about a smear campaign about Maurice McCabe, that you wouldn't inquire what that meeting was about. It is incomprehensible to me on any level.
And to everybody. That is a fact.
That's the truth.
Every person that you talk to finds these events to be utterly without credibility. The fact that the Taoiseach was able to say, in my opinion, the opinion of my party, she was less than forthcoming when she spoke in the Dáil on Thursday morning to Mary Lou MacDonald. But equally, two statements were issued by a senior minister, both of which contradict each other. Both of them cannot be true. We know that. Both of them cannot be true. This is a crisis that goes to the heart of government and deflecting it away and pointing fingers. There was no protected disclosure made to ministers upon. There was no reason to prevent her from having a discussion with the Minister for Justice. And I am not the only person who finds it utterly incredible that she wouldn't have brought those matters to the attention of the relevant people, one of whom most certainly, most definitely is the Minister for Justice. And on foot of that, our party whip, Angus O'Snoddy, has written to the Business Committee to request that she will come into the Dáil and that the business be reordered to facilitate a full and frank statement. And I also think we need to hear from Minister Zappone about which of her statements is correct. Perhaps she'll release another statement now, contradicting the other previous.
When is she back from the United States? You don't know?
I'm not sure, but I know Minister Zappone will be in the Dáil and I think he's taking questions on Tuesday, and I think it would be useful and appropriate that the Minister would make a statement. But can I say, well, can I say something here? Because there's very serious issues here, but let's not play politics with them. And I mean, we had the deputy leader of your party, Louise, yesterday, must have been exhausted from running in and out of the plinth holding doorsteps, and prematurely holding doorsteps, accusing the Taoiseach of misleading the Dáil, which simply was not the case. Now, your deputy leader stood up in the Dáil. Your deputy leader stood up in the Dáil on Thursday and asked the Taoiseach about other agencies. How much did your deputy leader know? Are people actually trying to play politics with this drip feeding the information? Everybody needs to be
frank. You're not
going
to deflect away from it with that.
Can I just make a point about this? Because this has turned into, as these things do, a political pointing fingers. Catherine Zappone is in the headlights right now because she happened to have that meeting. She happened to be the person with that information at that time. I think a much larger fundamental question arises out of this. And this is, what other information has the Taoiseach, the Justice Minister, had in her possession in relation to Maurice McCabe, in relation to other whistleblowers that she has been aware of over a prolonged period of time? And what has been done in relation to that? And how the Taoiseach framed these terms of reference for this commission.
The judge framed them because the judge was given terms of reference initially.
He was not allowed to consider, he was not asked to consider other whistleblowers' concerns. So of course he framed them, because that's all he was asked to do. He framed them on the basis of the information he was asked to consider, and he was asked to consider that information on the basis of what job he was given by the Taoiseach in the first place. So this is a sort of a Kafka thing. He was asked, he did the job he was asked to do, and it was a very narrow job. What I'm saying is that there is a much more fundamental question about how the government has handled Garda whistleblowers going back now two and a half years. And it has, there is whistleblowers out there today who are off sick, who have been harassed, who have extraordinary stories of intimidation that have all been laid out in black and white and put into protected disclosures, have been put into correspondence to the minister. And I think late in the day, we're all sitting around now, suddenly everybody's really, really, really worried about Maurice McCabe. But Maurice McCabe was out there on his own for a long time and really got very little public support or political support.
Well, yeah, but can I just say, because that's quite a charge against a government, Katie. I mean, and a government going back past this government to the government that Brendan and I were members of the last government. If you actually look at what's happened in relation to Sergeant Maurice McCabe, who has been failed by the state on many an occasion, I fully accept that. We've gone from a scenario where the then Garda Commissioner referred to him as disgusting, to a situation whereby cabinet ministers, like I rightly call him, distinguished and courageous. We've gone to a situation whereby we have very robust legislation, and legislation that Brendan and others would have pushed, and I acknowledge that, very robust legislation in relation to protected disclosures in relation to whistleblowers. We have a commission of investigation. We have put processes in place that simply did not exist. We've established the policing authority to remove the politics from the appointment of senior guards. These are all big, serious reforms that should be acknowledged.
I want to say a couple of points. Firstly, let's just take things issue by issue. In relation to the defence that Minister Zappone couldn't share the information, I just reject that. Number one, Article 28 of the Constitution is crystal clear. The Cabinet acts as a collective, and each are collectively responsible for every department of state. That can't constitutionally function unless you share information. And in relation to saying, well, this is private information of a sensitive nature, look at the Founding Act of TUSLA, the Child and Family Agency Act of 2013, sections 14 to 17, says specifically that they must provide the minister with the information she needs to carry out her duties, and she may use that appropriately, including publicly, never mind with cabinet colleagues. So it beggars belief that a tribunal of inquiry, the terms of reference of a commission of inquiry, could be discussed on this very matter. And the degree of knowledge that the Minister for Children would have would not be shared at the cabinet table. I've been privileged to be 10 years sitting around the cabinet table in three governments. It is just incredible. That minister,
what do you think of Katie Hannan's theory that you say, I've met as a minister, you say, I'm meeting Maurice McCain, and another minister says, yeah, thanks very much, that's enough information, I don't want to know anymore.
No, nobody said that.
Katie Hannan suggested it as a theory, and yeah, I'm just wondering what Brendan thinks.
I mean, that is a possibility, but if most, as we read in today's paper, most of the business of cabinet of that day was discussing across the table, as it was, the terms of reference for an inquiry into the allegations that there was a campaign of harassment against Maurice McCabe, and the Minister for Children knew the exact details of that and didn't share that around the cabinet table to ensure that the role of Tusla would be explicitly upfront mentioned, named. The notion that you'd sit back and say, I think it's captured, should be okay.
Nobody is buying that.
Well,
Minister, I know you jumped to her defence, but you did get in touch with her last night to ask her why she didn't tell you.
Well, can we at least just,
you had questions about it too.
Well, I think it's important that we do talk to cabinet colleagues. Cabinet colleagues regularly, but let's just look at Minister Zappone's words, because in fairness, she's not here, but she said it would have been highly inappropriate for the minister, so her spokesperson said, for the minister to brief the cabinet on confidential, highly sensitive and personal information, which one could reasonably assume was the subject of a protected disclosure, which was leading to the establishment of a commission. Can we at least accept, because I fully accept, the bona fides of Minister Zappone in trying to get to the bottom of this, in trying to assist the McCabes, and in making sure that the commission was established? What substantive difference would there have been in relation to the
because
terms of reference,
Tusla
which the
Taoiseach
has already confirmed to the Dáil?
Tusla should
will,
have
these
been explicitly
be
mentioned come. In the terms of reference, and I don't think, aside from yourself, Minister, I don't think there's anybody that would disagree with that. However,
oh, I agree, Tusla. Well, I agree that piece needs to be looked very clear.
Tusla should have been mentioned. And when they weren't, any person sitting around the cabinet table that had that knowledge should have lifted their hand and said, let's include a reference to Tusla. I find it utterly unbelievable, and I am not alone in this, that the Minister for Justice was made aware of a meeting between another minister and a very high profile Garda whistleblower, and she simply said, oh, thank you, that's grand, I won't ask you any further questions about that. That's nonsensical.
No one's suggesting she said that.
But what we are suggesting, Simon, let's just be clear, am I right? Because I'm genuinely confused about what we're being told here. Are we being told that the Taoiseach was informed that this meeting was taking place and no further information was shared at that moment or after that meeting? Is that actually what the government position is?
Well, what Minister Zappone, the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach have all confirmed publicly is that they were aware that Minister Zappone was meeting Sergeant McCabe, but they were not aware of the outcomes of those discussions. Because let's remember, before the primetime programme, Katie, and the information that, you know, the important information you put into the public domain, before the primetime programme, Minister Zappone was still involved in a process with the McCabes. She was still in conversation with the McCabes.
So the terms,
she hadn't finished
the terms
her work
of reference
with the McCabes.
For a,
and what she was trying to do, and different to what others decided,
without any input
and different to what others
from
decided
the person
to do,
who was seized of all
she
the
was
knowledge.
Not engaged. Actually, she decided, wasn't, Simon.
Well, she
wasn't.
Believes, well, she believes
she was,
Katie.
Because the letter from Tusla to the department, to the Secretary General of her department, was written on the 27th of January.
The discussions weren't over, Katie.
That there is no suggestion from the McCabes at any point that they believed that there was some confidentiality required from Catherine Zappone, and certainly that she couldn't share it.
Different people decide how to do different. Look, if let's just think about this. If somebody came to you and said, I'm after being wrongly accused of child abuse. I'm after being wrongly accused of the most heinous crime. It's false, it's wrong, and a state agency or state agencies got it wrong. How people decide to deal with that may differ. Some people have decided, and some people here have decided to put it into the public domain. You did, Brendan, and I respect your right to do that. Other people like Ministers of Pone felt that to support the McCabe family, who have described her as sympathetic and excellent,
this is completely
best to actually address her issue.
What we're talking
about
here.
You decided to put them into the public domain. No. She decided not to.
The difference between what actually happened and what you're saying is that the state agency had hands up, said, we are going to apologise to him, and had written that apology on the 27th of January.
I understand from my discussion with
Simon
Minister
is very good at misdirection.
Let us just look calmly
because I think people want to just have clarity in relation to this. The terms of reference of a really important commission of inquiry were being discussed at the highest level and across government.
Yes.
Framed by the Department of Justice and the Taoiseach. And the person best seized of all the knowledge of this, the Minister for Children, had nothing to say on it. No input to make about what the term should be. Is that what you're telling us?
I'm telling you that the Minister has said she was satisfied that the terms of reference adopted by the judge, put forward by the judge, encompassed the issues that she was discussing.
The second point I think is an important one made by Katie, and that is other whistleblowers. I think it's a really, really important issue. I just don't want to lose in the context of that, and that is the degree of knowledge, because I think we need to know all these things now.
Yes, and as it stands right now, we're hearing that TUSLA is going to be included in this.
Yes, correct.
Inquiry.
At least one other whistleblower says that there was a TUSLA referral made about him. A social worker was sent to his home, and inquiries made about the welfare of his children, that there was a referral went in from a senior Garda in the circumstances where this guard was a whistleblower and was causing a lot of trouble for that senior Garda. That whistleblower's case is not included in the terms of reference.
It's a GSOC.
So that's okay then. We're not going to proceed with a situation where these terms of reference will exclude those that case and those other whistleblowers.
Will there be another commission of inquiry then after this one to investigate those?
None of this is credible.
I'm going to leave this in a moment. Do you want a final word now? Because you did say yesterday that you want more information from TUSLA before the commission of investigation.
Yeah, I think, and I include the HSE in relation to this as well, because the HSE obviously provides counselling services and TUSLA provides child protection services. What I don't want to happen in terms of the point Brendan makes about the public confidence in our administrations and in our agencies, I don't want all of these issues to go off into a commission and say we'll answer all of them in the commission. There is useful information that TUSLA and the HSE can put into the public domain in addition to cooperating with the commission. What we don't need is to park every issue in a commission and say see it in 9 months.
No, but I think you've lost grasp of how fundamentally undermining the events of the last few days have been on public confidence in policing, as well as public confidence in the way we deal with child protection in this country. And we need to restore that. And that is not by saying, oh, well, it's been looked at by GSOC or it's been looked at by somebody else.
And how do you suggest it?
We certainly need to deal with other whistleblowers in the way that Katie has suggested. But more fundamentally, I'm afraid I've come to the conclusion that we do need a criminal investigation of all these matters, because the other element of all of this is people are fed up of endless commissions of inquiry that cost tens and hundreds of millions of euros that go on for years, and nobody is accountable at the end. Somebody must be held accountable for all these actions, and I think a criminal investigation, it will be challenging to set it up. But let's explore that at least.
What do you think about that? Criminal investigation or no?
I think we've jumped a number of steps here from actually having a process that's well established and that has been accepted by successive governments as a useful way of getting to the bottom of matters. We have a commission of investigation set up with very clear terms of reference. I think it should get on with its job now as quickly as possible.
Louise, this goes to, as I've said before, this goes to the heart of government. I would like to see the Minister for Justice in the Dáil at the earliest opportunity making a statement, and I hope that the Minister who is here can support that. I hope that Brendan will support that. I think she needs to come into the House and clarify, because it's in our opinion she was misleading in what she said. I think she needs to absolutely, well, you know, that's a matter of opinion,
and
if she's going to clear that up, let her come into the House and do it. That's the appropriate way to challenge this.
We will leave that one there. We're going to take a break. Katie Hannon, you're going to leave us now. Thank you very much for coming in. More after this. We've been joined in our studio by Dr. Brian Turner, who's health economist with UCC. Thanks very much, Brian, for coming in. Also with us, Minister for Health Simon Harris, Brendan Howland, Labour Party leader, and Louise O'Reilly, who is Sinn Féin's spokesperson on health. And to health we turn now, because before the Maurice McCabe story took precedence towards the end of the week, we were all talking about waiting lists after the RTE Living on the List programme. And Minister, your response elicited, we're told by the Irish Times, fury from the HSE. Some people said that you threw them under a bus by saying that all of this was a management issue and not a budgetary one.
But of course, I didn't say that. What I did say to you, indeed, when we did the interview, was that it is about more than just funding. Because if it wasn't just about funding, we would have solved the challenges in the health service many, many times.
But you met them subsequently, didn't you? Did they say that to you, that they were annoyed that you had said that?
No, they didn't say that to me. But I read it.
They were quite happy.
In the newspaper, like you did. But I'm very clear, my job is not to be a spokesperson for the HSE. My job is to be a spokesperson for government and on health matters, and to be a spokesperson, most importantly, for patients. So it's not my job to come into RTE studios and engage in bureaucratic speak about the health service. It's my job to call out things that are wrong, to highlight things that are right and demand more of them, and to do my very best to make improvements for our citizens. And I'm going to do that. I watched that programme here in RTE last week, and I couldn't have said I was anything other than ashamed and heartbroken. But that wasn't the totality of my response. And that's something that I found frustrating this week. The suggestion by some in the media of, Asher, there the minister goes again saying he's ashamed and heartbroken and it's unacceptable. I said that, but I also then outlined what we're going to do. And what we're going to do is we are going to make sure that every patient in this country waits less time for a hospital appointment or a hospital procedure this year than last year. We're going to make sure that the performance and accountability framework that our managers, and we've many, very many good ones right around the country, are measured up against, is about more than just checking they balance the budget, but that they also look at the other three things they sign on the dotted line to: quality of service, safety of service, how they utilise their workforce. And we're going to, when we have our 10-year plan for the health service, the cross-party plan that will be here in April, we're going to underpin in legislation structures that actually manage to finally, once and for all, rectify the structural challenges within our health service. Because up until this point, you ministers come, ministers go, and keep changing the structures. Mm. So the scale of the challenge is massive. But I don't apologise for suggesting that I have a job to do here, absolutely. But I'm not the only one that has a job to do.
But Brian Turner, you say your theory is that it is about investment. It is about management, but it's also about investment. And even though we're putting 14 billion a year in, it's not enough because we've had underinvestment for so many years over the recession.
Exactly. I think we need to look at the broader context of the health system at the moment. I mean, we had massive underfunding of the system in the late 80s and the early 1990s. Roughly about 6,000 beds were cut out of the system. We've never really recovered from that. Now, I know that we're moving away from inpatient to day case care, and I know that we're trying to get people out of hospitals and into primary care. But when you look at the overcrowding in A&Es, and when you look at the waiting lists, certainly we could do with some of those beds back. So we are under-resourced, particularly in terms of hospital beds and in terms of doctors and particularly consultants. Now, we're also under-resourced in terms of nurses, but it's slightly harder to get the figures on that because of the differences in the way the figures are collected. But we need more resources in the system, and that's obviously going to cost money.
To hit the OECD average, according to your research, we'd need 9,000 more beds.
Over 9,000 beds, yeah.
And 2,800 doctors.
Exactly, yeah. So that, now, having said that, you could argue that, well, maybe we don't need to go up to the OECD average because we have a younger than average population, but it just shows the scale of how under-resourced the system is. So we're not talking about opening a couple of hundred beds here or there. We're going to need thousands of extra beds. We're going to need thousands of extra doctors. So that just emphasises the scale of the challenge to which the Minister has just alluded.
We're also going to need thousands of extra nurses. Yeah. And we note this week that the INMO and I think SIPCHU as well have balloted for industrial action. And, there is a crisis, not just in recruitment of nurses, there is a crisis in retention of nurses. So it's all very well to talk about capacity, and we all know that there is a capacity deficit within the health service, and it's all very well to talk about primary care. But this is an issue with regard to policy. It is government policy not to properly resource our primary care centres. Well, I can cite the example of the centre in my own constituency, Minister, in Balbriggan. I've asked three times now the same questions: what additional resources are going to be deployed? And the answer I get, it will be managed from within existing, developed, sorry, from within existing resources. When I have asked specifically how many additional bodies are we going to have in Fingal with the fastest growing population in the country, I get the answer back. It's a nice round figure. It's zero. So it is government policy not to invest in our primary care service, which puts undue pressure on our acute hospital sector. So we now see 500, 550, 600 plus people on trolleys. That is a disgraceful way for citizens to be treated, quite apart from anything else. But those people are stuck there because there are not beds. We can't have beds unless we have staff, and we won't have staff for as long as we keep treating the staff in the health service in the way that this government and the previous government have treated them. I'm not surprised that they're going on strike.
Simon, you can back in a moment, but yeah, I want to bring
Brendan
in here.
I think what's happened for the last 20 years, not for the last two or three or five years, the last 20 years, is that we've had responses to the latest crisis, and resources were put in to the crisis that manifested itself without any joined up look at how a modern 21st century health service is presented and structured. And it always is good for an opposition, and I'm in opposition, to be able to have something to shout about. But that's not a solution that people need. And bluntly, in all the research done in the last couple of years, people have no confidence anymore that politicians can fix it. And that's shocking. So what we need to do, and I welcome the notion of an all-party committee to look at structurally, but we need to be brave in relation to how we restructure the health services. Number one, we need to ensure that we all agree on the plan that we lay it out in legislation so that it is not dependent on the whims of the next administration or the policies put out in the next manifesto, and also that it is properly resourced. And that means knowing how much money is actually required, because I remember, you know, in the last 5 years, obviously, when we had very little money, one of the things I did is I went to the OECD in Paris to look at the very figures that had been talked about. I said, give me the best experts in the OECD to point me to the best health system that we can look at. And they, you know what they told me? There is no model we can point you to. There, every single health system is under strain for a variety of different reasons. Now, the problem about restructuring a health system is that you're dealing with demand every day, and it's very difficult to rebuild and carry on the core work. The objective of the last, I suppose, 10 years of government policy has been to really develop primary care, to take the pressure off the acute system, because we too many people, as their first port of call, have to go to accident and emergency because they don't feel they can go to a health centre that will provide proper diagnosis to them, give them x-rays, do all the things. We prioritise that in the last 5 years, but we need to put this up front now to provide proper primary health care for everybody. But can I make one other suggestion to Simon? And it's something, again, that I tried more than 20 years ago, because we do need short-term fixes as well as the long-term strategic fix.
That's true.
And the short-term fix that I might suggest to you in relation to waiting lists, for example, and it's waiting times is much more important than waiting lists, how long you're waiting as opposed to the number waiting. I took a waiting list initiative 23 years ago. I got a sum of money together, and it can be a significant sum now because money is available, and simply ask every hospital in the country to bid for money. How many additional procedures can you do? And tell me the cost of it. Additional hips. I mean, the notion that we've a long waiting list for cataract operations, which cost 2,000 quid and take 20 minutes, is astonishing to me. There must be a process that we can simply allocate a chunk of money and buy those procedures in our public system now by people working out of hours.
We're buying them in the private system, isn't that what we're doing?
I mean, this is to have a system that requires people to be pushed into the private system, often provided by the same clinicians, is wrong. And I think we should look beyond Ireland. If in the north or in Britain there are people who can do that, let's buy those until we eliminate the waiting lists.
Brian, can I come back to you on a point that Stephen Kinsler, the economist at UL, makes? 42% of HSE staff are involved in admin or support. Now, I don't know if you've looked at that in detail, but in the NHS it's 20% and in private hospitals it's 10%. I mean, that's a glaringly obvious problem if those numbers are correct.
It is indeed. And I suppose to put things into context, the CSO came out with a new system of health accounts starting in 2015, and based on the figures, we spend about 3% of the entire health budget on administration. So in the greater context, it's not, you know, huge money relative to the budget and the health system. But just to pick up on the point in terms of the National Treatment Purchase Fund and treating public patients privately, in the short term, that is a pragmatic approach. But I think long term, and I think the Committee on the Future of Healthcare is looking at this, we need to separate out the public and the private systems, because we have a huge amount of overlap there. So we're talking now about having public patients treated privately by the National Treatment Purchase Fund because they can't get into public hospitals in a timely fashion, yet significant numbers of patients in public hospitals are private patients. I mean, the latest figures for 2015 show 121,800 private inpatient discharges and over 143,000 private day case discharges from public hospitals. So they need to swap. It makes no sense to have people treated privately because they can't get into public hospitals because private patients are in the public hospitals. We need to separate out the public and private systems.
And
more
it's
than
counterintuitive for the minister to suggest, as he does repeatedly, supported by Fianna Fáil, that somehow investing in the private sector, in the NTPF or any other measure, is going to magically improve the public service. It just won't.
No,
what we saw on Monday night, and I would take my hat off to those programme makers, but also to the people who were waiting. Every single one of them represents 10, 50 or 100,000 people also waiting in pain. What we saw was that the figures had been manipulated and that the true figures were not on the public record, and they are now. But I'm a member of that Future Healthcare Committee, and we are working really, really hard to come up with a report. But I feel sometimes like the government is working against us and that the minister is working against us, because we didn't have the full set of figures in relation to the waiting lists. So now, thanks to RTE, we have them. Well, but then you're back to ask, well, what else is happening that we don't know? And all the while, we're talking about building universal access to the public health service. The minister, egged on by Fianna Fáil and their confidence in supply agreement, are channeling money into the NTPF.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take a break because I have to, and then we'll let you have a good run after that. We'll take this break here. Minister Simon Harris, lots of stuff lobbed at you there before the break. Where do you want to start? Because I want to ask you about performance and HSE managers as well. If you want to start with that, we can, because it's said in the paper today that you don't have the equipment to deal with managers who are underperforming.
Sure.
They can be shifted around, but you can't take them out.
Well, the only thing I want to start with before I answer that question directly is I do think after the week that we've had, and rightfully the expose that RTE did on the waiting list program, on the waiting list situation, it is important to acknowledge that there's an awful lot of things in the Irish Health Service that go well. And I make that point not as a political point, but in recognition to all of the frontline staff who do work extraordinarily hard. I launched the Daffodil Day appeal yesterday for the Irish Cancer Society in Croke Park with thousands of volunteers there from around the country. And if you look at the journey the country's made, not me, but successive ministers in relation to cancer care. So, I mean, it is just, we do just need to have a sense of perspective on that there's an awful lot of things that go well in the Irish Health Service, and there's a number of serious problems that we have to address. In relation to management, we do have a performance and accountability framework. And let's talk about this for one second. This is a document that was drawn up by myself and Pascal Donoghue, who is the Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, and the HSE. And it is the document that managers sign up to. This is what I commit to being measured against. And it measures the managers against four things, and I've outlined them already. Three of them are directly related to patients. They're related to access, quality, and how the workforce is
utilised. What happens to those people who fail those tests?
I'm frustrated because I don't believe that we're rigorously applying the framework to every manager. And it's not about, and I am frustrated that this week it has been kind of reduced to the minister wants to get rid of managers. It's not about that. The performance framework says that where there is a problem, where there's a difficulty, where there's an underperformance, you put in place improvement plans. This is what happens in every organisation. You go in and you say, hang on a second, Hospital X, what you're doing here isn't working. Have you looked at what Hospital Y is doing? Now, here's your improvement plan to get here, and we're going to come back in 6 months and see how you're getting
on. So what happens if you come back in 6 months and the improvement plan hasn't been implemented?
Well, the performance framework is clear on this, and these aren't my words. It says it, that, you know, that then after that, people can be formed with performance notices, and ultimately it says can be removed from post. Now, whether that means people can be sacked or whether that means people are moved to other duties, from my point of view, is not the crux of the issue. The crux of the issue is we have the best people. Well, anybody in any organisation can be sacked if they're in breach of their contract. But the discussion I've been trying to have isn't about sacking. It's about actually trying to incentivise good behaviour. We had a hospital in this country, Beaumont. Beaumont has always been, or has historically been, one of the hospitals with one of the highest trolley figures in the country. Over the last number of months of 2016, it came in consistently below where it was. I mean, dramatic reductions. We had some months where there were 40% less people on trolleys. I would have liked to see a scenario where that was held up as a bastion of good practice. What did they do in that hospital to achieve that? And why don't we demand that in more places? We had hospitals in terms of waiting lists, like Cavan, where they made huge inroads in relation to their waiting lists, and we had others that simply didn't. So when I talk about shining a light on this, we've got to shine a light on good practice and demand more. And that's what performance and accountability is about. It's not an alien concept. It shouldn't be seen as some sort of mad radical idea. It should be seen as good practice.
But there is, I mean, the bottom line in relation to health, and as a health minister of many, many years ago, the health system is ad hoc. There is no uniform standard. If you look at the resourcing available to each hospital, it is built up over time in a completely different pattern. So, for example, if you look at the throughput of any hospital and look at the resources in terms of doctors, nurses and cash available to it, there is no standard. What we need is to have an objective look at the needs of it. And unfortunately, a lot of that becomes political. Because if you say that there
that's the big problem, isn't it, with our... It is political.
That's exactly it. And because it is a political issue, we haven't been able to get a consensus approach to a solution. I hope on Louise's committee now that we can work towards a solution. But bluntly, devising a framework isn't enough. I hope that there will be a cross-party agreement on devising the exact resources needed to implement that and a commitment that whatever comes over time, that we will provide that.
Yeah, Brian Turner, I just want to come to you on a couple of quick things that you think perhaps could be done in the short to medium term to get us out of this waiting list problem that we're in.
Okay, well, I do think that the use of the National Treatment Purchase Fund is a pragmatic approach in the short term, but it should not be relied on in the long term.
We need to
unpick the
overlap. And what about just asking, look, every hospital, as I've suggested, can you utilise the out-of-hours...
Can insource as well as outsource, yes.
I think that really can have an impact.
Insourcing should be a part of it.
Will you do that?
You need staff to do that.
We will both insource and outsource.
You need staff to do that, and the staff in the health service have balloted for Industrial Action Minister. They are now in dispute with their employers.
And we're going to try and resolve that. 3 weeks and 4 days to sit down and try and sort that out, and that's what I want to do.
Brian, do you want to carry on
there? I suppose the other thing is, I suppose, as has just been mentioned, looking at the if there is capacity out-of-hours to try and utilise that.
With more money.
With more, exactly. It is going to take more money. So I think ultimately this is going to boil down to, okay, we need to put more money in. We need to find that money fairly quickly to try and get over this waiting list issue in the short term and then try and reform the system in the longer term.
Okay. And lest anyone is losing faith in humanity, I should tell you that subsequently after the programme on Monday night and after Clare Burn Live afterwards, that we had many members of the public phoning in offering to pay privately for operations for people who were waiting. We had private hospitals also offering to carry out surgeries, and a lot of them got looked after subsequently and quite quickly. So that's some good news on the back of that.
Yes.
We have about a minute left. Brendan Howland, are we heading for an election given the week that we've had?
I don't know. I think we're closer to an election than we were 3 days ago. There's no doubt about that. I predicted
down to Fianna Fáil, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I predicted 12 months ago that this government wouldn't survive a year. I thought at Christmas time I might have been wrong. It might survive longer. But it hasn't the capacity to do anything, and that's the real issue. We can survive a while by just, you know, ticking over doing the nuts and bolts of administration. But any real issue that has to be addressed, the government doesn't command a majority in the House. It's dependent on the whim of Fianna Fáil.
Mm-hmm. But Fianna Fáil are saying, in light of what's happened in the last couple of days, that they are happy for Noreen O'Sullivan to stay in position, Louise O'Reilly, your take on this, and they're happy for the Commission to do its work. So no move there.
The confidence and supply agreement that Fianna Fáil have with the government must be very, very elastic indeed if it can stretch to cover what we have seen in terms of the misinformation on the waiting list figures, what has happened with regard to Maurice McCabe, and all of the stuff that is now coming into the public domain that is causing not just a crisis in confidence with our institutions, but I think a crisis in confidence with our government. I don't believe that Fianna Fáil are going to be able to stand over the revelations that have appeared this week. I don't think that the confidence and supply agreement is elastic enough to cover those scenarios. And I do believe that the people deserve an election.
People deserve an election, Simon Harris?
I don't believe the people want an election. We face so many challenges in relation to Brexit, in relation to the Trump administration, in relation to our society, our health service. We've got to get on with the job. This government is getting a lot of things done. It's having to do them in different ways. It's having to engage. It's having to win the argument. This is new politics. We are making the very best of the political situation we've been given.
All right, we've got to leave it there. Thank you all very much indeed, Brian Turner. Particular thanks to you and to Katie Hannon, who joined us earlier. Back on Monday night, 10:35 on RT1 with Clare Byrne Live. See you then. Have a good weekend.
Saturday with Clare Byrne was produced by Kay Sheehy. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan. The researcher, Annette Egan, and sound supervision was by Noel Roberts.